Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
The men that were flying these things didn't see themselves as sacrificing their lives to take out a merchant ship. To admit that the kamikaze campaign had failed by the end of the Philippines would have been to admit that you sacrificed all those brave men to no good purpose.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Mark Lardas has been fascinated by all things related to the sea and sky his entire life. From building models of ships and aircraft as a teen to studying naval architecture and marine engineering at college. He worked as a navigation engineer on the Shuttle program and is now employed at Johnson Space Center on the Lunar Gateway program. He's written extensively about aircraft, warships, and he's authored more than 50 books on military, naval, and maritime history. Mark joins us today to talk about his book, The Kamikaze Campaign, 44 to 45, Imperial Japan's Last Throw of the Dice, his book published by Osprey. Mark, of course, was a major part of our Coastal Command series, which was nominated for an International Aerospace Media Award in 2021-22. And he can be found on our back catalogue on episodes 124, The Battle for the Atlantic, and 129, The Adversaries. Today, Mark's calling in from Texas. So, Mark, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back. Thank you for joining us. I was fascinated by the book. I loved it. Let's go back. Can you explain to us what is kamikaze? What does it mean?
Kamikaze literally means divine wind. And it is a reference to a typhoon that hit the Mongol invasion fleet back in the 12th century when they were going to invade Japan. The typhoon came up and scattered the fleet, much like the Spanish Armada ends up getting scattered by winds north of England. And for the Japanese, it was remembered in kind of the same way as divine intervention coming to protect Yamato, the home islands. And the term was adopted we call it kamikaze. The Japanese had another name for those types of attack, toko attacks. The Navy called it kamikaze when they first started it, and the Army sort of never liked the term because the Imperial Army and the Imperial Navy were always at sword's point through most of Imperial Japanese history. The only thing that the Army liked more than putting one up on the Navy was putting one up on the enemy and vice versa.
Okay. Yeah. So we all recognize how this was eventually deployed, but can you give us a background to why did the Japanese come to the conclusion that there was a need for this approach? How did it start out?
In the Imperial Japanese culture, sacrificing yourself for the emperor was the best thing that you could do. There had always been a strain in Japanese military and naval culture of an individual making a suicidal attack that would grant victory to the Japanese on the field. And that predated the kamikaze campaign. There are instances of that in the 1904-1905 Russo-Japanese War. There were a couple of famous instances during the opening of the Second Sino-Soviet or Sino-Japanese War in 1937. So they had a predisposition to, you know, essentially launch a suicidal attack against an enemy. It's not limited to Japan, by the way. There were cases during the Pacific War where U.S. flyers, typically those that were mortally wounded, would deliberately crash an airplane into an enemy vessel. Probably the best known example of that is the famous picture of the Mogami during the Battle of Midway, where you can see a dive bomber crashed on one of its rear turrets. The difference is that typically up until late 1944, this was all done on an ad hoc basis made by personal decision on the part of the Japanese. Really, again, you'll see it in virtually every nation on occasion. Again, typically if the pilot is convinced that they are mortally wounded and you might as well take one with you. But what was happening in 1944 is Japan had been at the end of a long losing streak, and a lot of the junior officers were coming to the conclusion that making conventional attacks against U.S. or against Allied forces were pretty much futile because you were going to get shot down during the mission. Even if you successfully dropped a bomb, you weren't returning anyway. So some of them began advocating that the best way to stop the Allied advance was to literally turn your aircraft into a guided missile, with the pilot serving as the guidance system, and literally crash the aircraft into the enemy vessel. By the end of the Battle of the Philippine, after the Battle of the Philippine Sea, it became apparent to Japan that unless they did something different, they were going to lose the war. So again, this bubbled up from the junior officers and not the admirals on down, and it started with the Navy.
They
organized units that were intended to crash into enemy vessels, preferably aircraft carriers. There is some indication that this tactic might have been used during the attacks on Formosa, the U.S. raids on Formosa immediately prior to the invasion of the Philippines.
Right,
but
okay.
You can't be sure of that because basically it was like a handful of aircraft and they were all shot down before they got close enough to the American ships for it to be apparent that they were trying to crash into the American ships.
Yeah, okay. And of course there was, the view that some of the aircraft the Japanese flew, and certainly some of the more experienced pilots, were very able. And so it must have been very difficult to judge whether they were flying from a skilled position or whether they were unskilled pilots, literally aiming the aircraft at the target.
Correct. The first time it was formally deployed was during the Battle of the Philippine Sea, when the first Toko units were sent against American carriers. And this was against the escort carriers. And the United States had three task groups of escort carriers that were covering the invasion beaches, while Task Force 38, which were the fast carriers, were going after the Japanese fleet. So the thing is that these first pilots, and they were experienced pilots, by the way. They sent out an attack against what they thought was a fast carrier group, which was actually, as I said, it was one of the three, the code name for these were Taffies. So they were Taffy 1, Taffy 2, Taffy 3. Basically they ended up going out both with attacking aircraft and with observers. And they went after Task Group 77 4.1, and started essentially trying to crash on them.
And what was the organization of that in the first instance, Mark? How did they organize themselves and get their tactics?
Oh, they had formal units that were supposed to expend themselves. And
the Japanese were running out of both skilled pilots as well as aircraft at that time. How could they have afforded aircraft in effect that they knew would never return?
They had a surplus of aircraft. They just didn't have a surplus of aircraft that were capable of meeting the first line Allied aircraft. And actually, as the kamikaze campaign went on, as it started, initially what they were using were the Zeros, which was the frontline fighter in 1941-42, but had really become a secondary aircraft by late 1944. Right. And they were essentially just mounting a bomb on this airplane and crashing it into the Allied ship. Okay.
Right.
And as I said, one of the things about the Philippines was that was where they had their air training schools, their pilot schools. The reason for that being it was close to the Dutch East Indies where they were getting the fuel for their aircraft, which the Japanese then controlled. So why bother sending the fuel all the way up to Japan when you've got Philippines next to the East Indies, next to your fuel source, and the ships don't have to go as far against and face the potential of being sunk by U.S. submarines. So the Army particularly had a lot of training fields in the Philippines. So they had a lot of aircraft there. They had a lot of pilots there. Although what I want to stress is that in the first couple of months of the kamikaze campaign, it wasn't the trainees that were flying these missions. It was the experienced pilots that were willing to sacrifice themselves in order to turn the war around. And in some cases, it was their aces. And there's at least one case where there was an ace that really wanted to fly one of these missions. And they decided, no, they couldn't lose this guy. So they ordered him flown out of the Philippines. And the transport he was in got intercepted and shot down by American fighters.
Irony there.
Yeah. But
yeah, sure.
The point is that this first round was done with skilled pilots flying typically Zeros, although they were also flying the standard Japanese dive bomber as well. And basically, the first round they attacked this formation of, I believe it was 4 to 6 aircraft carriers. They thought it was one of the elements of Task Force 38, because frankly, from 20,000 feet, it's kind of hard to tell the difference between an escort carrier and a fleet carrier. I mean, you know, they've got pretty much the same profile, deck profiles. So, on that attack, I believe they hit 4 carriers, created major fires on them. One of them actually sank. The other 3, the damage control brought the fires under control after the observing aircraft left. The observing aircraft which were familiar with Japanese damage control capabilities, saw the flames on these ships and reported that all four had been sunk, which was reasonable based on Japanese experience. I mean, we're coming off the Battle of the Philippine Sea, where two of their fleet carriers ended up getting sunk primarily because of bad damage control. So you see this carrier that's a massive ball of flames, and you figure it's a goner. So they go back and they say, hey, guys, we sank four fleet carriers. And Japanese high command said, this is fantastic. We've found the secret formula to win the war. Up until that point, the whole kamikaze campaign really was more an experiment than anything else. Had those guys gone back and said, we missed, it didn't work, they probably would have canceled it. Well, possibly they would have canceled it. Because it's, as I said, this was being pushed by the pilots themselves initially. And at that point they thought, oh, we've figured out a way to stop the Americans. In one attack, we've managed to reduce the fast carrier force by 25%.
Yeah.
Let's keep pushing this. And they accepted other volunteers. And for the next month, this was essentially October, November 1944, they started launching a massive series, the Navy started launching a massive series of attacks against American ships.
Sorry to interrupt you there. How did the then Americans and the Allies respond to this? I mean, what was their first perception of these attacks?
Well, at first, they couldn't believe that the Japanese were doing this. Then, once they realized what was going on, at first what they did was simply more of what they had been doing, send up more combat air patrols, increase anti-aircraft fire, and so forth. However, in late November, Task Force 38 had pretty much finished its support in the Philippines, and they were at the Ulithi Anchorage. And basically, what they did was analyze what happened and then come up with a series of defenses against it. Part of that was tactics to prevent the Japanese from sneaking in with U.S. aircraft, because one of the things the Japanese had been doing was when the carriers launched an attack, after the attack, they would follow the American aircraft back to the carriers. So they developed, the U.S. developed a series of tactics. And one of the people that was involved with this was Thach. He was the guy in the beginning of the war that developed the Thach weave. And by that point in the war, he was on the staff of the fast carrier force. So they developed a number of tactics, one of which was to set up picket destroyers in advance of the carriers to give advance warning of aircraft coming in. The other thing they did is they had what they called Tomcat destroyers that were ahead of and behind the carrier group. So when when the aircraft returned to the carriers, instead of returning directly to the carriers, they would fly over these Tomcat destroyers and circle over them so they could be observed. And if there were any Japanese aircraft with them, they would be intercepted by a combat air patrol force that was over the destroyer.
Yeah.
This was called delousing.
Okay. What was the psychological effect on the Allied sailors and
they didn't like it. You know, as one of them put it, it's one thing when they're dropping bombs on you. It's something else entirely when they're trying to light on you.
Yeah.
I believe that Nimitz, said that during the Pacific War, the only surprise to us was the kamikaze tactic. This was anathema to the United States, where, yeah, you're always supposed to, you might go in against really high odds, but you weren't supposed to deliberately kill your, go in thinking you were going to kill yourself. It created a great deal of fear. And actually, it was a really good example of Ben Jonson's aphorism that the prospect of being hanged in 2 weeks has a powerful effect of clarifying one's thinking. Because a lot of these tactics that I'm describing were developed as a result of the kamikaze campaign. The other thing that they did was they vastly increased the amount of fighters on the American carriers, whereas before it was one-third fighters, one-third dive bombers, one-third torpedo bombers. After the kamikaze attack started, it switched to about three-quarters fighters, 10% dive bombers, and 15% torpedo bombers. Now, part of the reason for that was they could also use the fighters as fighter bombers. But another part of the reason for that was it increased the number of fighters that you had in order to defend against the kamikazes.
Yeah. Okay. And what aircraft types were involved from? We talked about the Zero, and right. I do need to come and ask you about the, is it the Oka flying bomb? But they were using different types of aircraft, weren't they? And different tactics.
They essentially used, initially, they were using the Zero, the Vals, and the Judies, the Yokosuka D4Y1. As the campaign went on, now remember, those three are Navy aircraft. After the Navy sort of showed the way with this, the Imperial Japanese Army joined in, and the number of aircraft used expanded until it was practically any aircraft the Japanese had, including trainers, although that was towards the end of the campaign. But during the first phase, it was the aircraft I'd mentioned, the Yokosuka Ginka, which was a twin-engine bomber. The Army used the Hein, the Ki-48, which was a twin-engine light bomber, and they actually developed a specific suicide airplane called the Nakajima Ki-115, although as near as I can tell, that was never deployed in operation. But basically, if it had an engine and it flew and you could put a 500-pound bomb on it, it was a kamikaze at one point or another during the campaign.
Yeah. And did they always carry bombs, or when they configured the aircraft, I know they only fueled them for enough fuel, or did they overfuel them for the incendiary effect? And did they always carry bombs?
Did. Okay. They would put a 250 kilogram bomb or a 500 kilogram bomb on the aircraft, depending on what it was capable of carrying, fueled it up pretty much as normal, because there was also always the possibility that you wouldn't find the enemy aircraft, enemy ships, and you'd have to return. Now, talking about the Philippine phase of the campaign. Once you get to Iwo Jima or Okinawa, it ends up being pretty much a one-way trip because of the distance involved, particularly with Iwo Jima. And Iwo Jima was one of the places where you saw a lot of twin-engine aircraft being used as kamikazes just because of the range involved.
And did their tactics, did the tactics change at all, Mark? As the battle for the Pacific moved into the different theaters, did the Japanese kamikaze tactics change at all?
it depends on how you define tactics. The two basic ways of attacking a ship using kamikaze tactics was either to come in from a high altitude and then dive onto the ship, or to come in at very low altitude, hoping to go below the radar and then pop up and then dive into the ship. That was a constant. In terms of pilots used and skill, that changed over the life of the campaign, because initially, as I said, they had skilled pilots, but if you're using them for kamikaze, you run out of skilled pilots. They also were running out of aircraft, the preferred aircraft for these tactics. So as the war goes on, they're starting to use pilots that are less skilled and aircraft that are less capable. Surprisingly, one of the most effective kamikazes was the Willow Trainer, which was essentially a fabric and wood biplane. And the reason that thing was so effective was because it was made of materials that didn't show up well on radar, so it was essentially a World War II equivalent of a stealth aircraft. They were easy to shoot down once you saw them, but a lot more of them got close to the shoot down range than the standard metal aircraft, because one of the things the U.S. did was intercept them as far away from the fleet as possible. The other way that the tactics changed was that the first group of pilots were looking for carriers. Okay, if they couldn't find a carrier, let's find the biggest ship we can, which would mean a battleship, preferably. And you could tell the difference between a battleship and a cruiser. They were, you know, a quantum leap larger. As the campaign went on and the skill of the pilots deteriorated, it was basically, let's go after the first ship that we see. And those would inevitably be those picket destroyers that were placed in advance of the fleet in order to provide warning. So the destroyers and the destroyer escorts ended up taking the brunt of the attack, particularly in the Okinawa phase of the campaign. You know, one thing that I haven't mentioned so far is that one of the reasons that the U.S. was effective against stopping this was they had begun to implement the use of what were called the proximity fuse prior to the invasion of the Philippines, but they'd been reluctant to use them as much as they could have because they were afraid that you would get duds falling into Japanese hands and that the Japanese would build their own version of it. After the kamikazes started, the use of the VT, the proximity fuse, skyrocketed. The other thing that they did was they added a lot more 40mm and 20mm guns on the U.S. Yeah. ships in order to yeah. increase the whole anti-aircraft capability.
Yeah, so, and you talk in the book about how they put up literally rain of metal into the air to literally to fill the air full of as much shot as possible to try and take as much down. And right. that development of things like the picket ships and that whole process is an ethos that's come through naval philosophy now since the Second World War. I mean, we saw the use of a similar mechanism by the British in the Falkland Island war, for example, of using those picket ships out in advance. And it was developed very much in the Pacific, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. But yeah, I mean, we're seeing it 40 years later.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And one of the points you make in the book is, and I think the term you used with me, were there were some unsexy parts of warfare, like damage control, the operational doctrine,
right.
logistics that made a significant difference to the way that the Allies responded to the kamikaze. Right.
The best way I can put it is the fog nozzle defeated the kamikaze.
and right.
again, I mean, remember what I was saying earlier about fire, about damage control. One of the things that the United States had learned early in World War II, the 1942 loss of Saratoga, the loss of the Hornet in 1943, was how important damage control was. Some of the changes, for example, were, sailors were required to wear long sleeve shirts and pants in combat to protect them from flash burns. The other thing is the fog nozzle, which was something they put on fire hoses that essentially created a spray instead of a stream. And the thing is that, you know, in firefighting, they talk about you've got fuel, heat, and air. Well, you can't take away the fuel and you can't take away the air, but spraying water on a fire uses a lot of heat. And what the fog nozzle did was it maximized the amount of heat that the water took from the fire, robbed from the fire, and ended up reducing it quickly. So yeah. The Japanese would see these massive fires. The Americans would end up putting them out using something the Japanese didn't have, which was pretty much the unsexy fog nozzle. On top of that, one of the things that the United States learned was you needed the fire pumps to be running. So they put a lot of auxiliary generators, particularly aircraft carriers, but on all ships, even adding them to the destroyers that had been built without them back in the early 1930s. And the thing is, prior to that, all of the electrical power was run off of the main engines, which meant if you lost your engines, you lost power, you lost the ability to run the fire hoses, you lost the ability to run the pumps that pumped out the water that was coming in. And additionally, the United States ended up doing extensive training in damage control. All of this minimized the effect of the kamikazes. The other thing is that the kamikazes by themselves weren't very effective because the only thing they could damage was the superstructure of the ship. If you look at a carrier, that carrier deck is not what the Navy would call the weather deck. That's several decks down. And that's the actual part of the hull that maintains watertight
integrity. Yeah, yeah. The structural integrity of the ship wasn't being always damaged,
right.
was it? Much
right.
of the damage was
right.
superficial.
Right. So basically the kamikaze would hit, it would rip through the flight deck and go into the hangar deck, which is still above the typically above the weather deck on a fleet carrier, and it would create a massive fire. Now, if that fire went out of control, yeah, the ship would end up burning and sinking. And a couple of that happened with the escort carriers, which had a lot less damage control capability than the fleet carriers. With the British aircraft carriers, they had armored flight decks. It was really only an inch or two of armor, but if a kamikaze hit the British carrier, it wouldn't even penetrate the flight deck. And as one American observer aboard a British carrier said, at that point it was sweepers fore and aft. So the British task force that was attached to the Pacific, U.S. Pacific Fleet ended up getting hit by kamikazes on several occasions and just continued working. The United States had made the calculation that using a wooden flight deck meant you could carry more aircraft. And in theory, the carriers were supposed to be dishing it out and not being attacked. If
yeah,
they were being attacked,
yeah.
that meant you'd done something wrong.
Understood. And where does the kamikaze approach from the Japanese start to appear to, I don't know if fail is the right word, but how do they recognize that it's no longer working? Does it continue right up to the end of the war?
It continued up to the end of the war and would have continued into an American invasion of Japan. By the end of the Philippines campaign, Japan pretty much realized, no, this isn't going to work. It didn't stop them at the Philippines. It's not going to stop them. It probably won't stop them later. But there's a gambling concept of sunk costs. Once you've put money in the kitty, that money is gone. The problem is, with a lot of gamblers and with the Japanese, the fact that you'd spent that money provided an emotional cost. To admit that the kamikaze campaign had failed by the end of the Philippines would have been to admit that you sacrificed all those brave men to no good purpose. And the high command didn't feel like they could do that. So I guess, you know, to use an aphorism of a much later American general, they doubled down on stupid. They decided that since the cost had been so high, they had to continue it because that was the only tactic they had that had the possibility of stopping the Americans. The part of the problem was, could it have been effective even at Okinawa or particularly Okinawa? The answer is it could have been, but only if the Japanese went after the U.S. transports. And again, the men that were flying these things didn't see themselves as sacrificing their lives to take out a merchant ship. You know, if you're going to go, let's take out the biggest warship you can find. So they were taking out essentially these destroyers and destroyer escorts that the United States, they had so many destroyer escorts, they were canceling production of them. So
And it's not to take away from the damage that they did cause, but as we've seen recently in the recent war in the Ukraine, logistics is everything. If you've got a good logistics and supply chain, then you can keep feeding your army, your air force, your navy.
But the Japanese never appreciated the role logistics played from, you know, Pearl Harbor on. You know, just to give one example, if they targeted the tank farms when they attacked Pearl Harbor as their primary target, the tank farms and the repair facilities, the net result would have been identical to the result of the actual Pearl Harbor raid. The battles, everything, not just the battleships, but everything would have been forced back to the U.S. Pacific coast because they couldn't have maintained even the carriers and the cruisers.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Let's get back to Operation Olympic and Operation Coronet, which were the two planned U.S. invasions of Japan. And Olympic was Kyushu, Coronet was Honshu around the Tokyo area. The Japanese had essentially grounded their air force, both Navy and Army, after the Okinawa campaign wrapped up, essentially intending to use the entire Air Force as a kamikaze strike against the invasion fleets. They were, as I said, they had manufactured a specific kamikaze aircraft, the KI-115, which had such interesting features as landing gear that fell away. It was fixed landing gear. You pulled a handle, it dropped off. And the idea was that they were going to smash the invasion fleet as it came in. They were planning on launching these aircraft from improvised airfields all over Kyushu, because that was the emphasis, was if you stopped Olympic, then you would stop the invasion of Honshu. And they were essentially grass fields, and they were concealing the aircraft in barns and caves. And they were really planning on making a massive strike against the U.S. The U.S. plan was to capture some islands immediately south of Kyushu before Operation Olympic, and then staging a whole bunch of U.S. Army fighters in those islands to help tame the kamikaze threat. What would have happened, I don't know. I suspect it wouldn't have been nearly as effective as the Japanese had hoped, or as ineffective as the United States desired. It would have made the Okinawa campaign look absolutely pale by comparison.
Yeah, yeah. So let's look back then, Mark, on the results of the kamikaze campaign and what effect it had. I mean, I saw a figure. I was doing a little bit of reading earlier this week outside of the book, and I saw a figure that quoted that they were 7 to 10 times more effective than a standard Japanese Navy attack. Is that true? Were they that effective?
They were a little more effective. It's hard to really say how much more effective it would have been without the kamikazes. The real problem was that it wasn't good enough. And what you were doing was essentially killing the future post-war leaders of Japan. At that point, basically the only thing that Japan could have done was figure out some graceful surrender. And until Hirohito intervened, the Japanese military wasn't willing to do that. In fact, even after he intervened, there was an attempted coup to continue the war, again, led by those junior officers that had pretty much triggered the Second Sino-Japanese War that had led to a military government taking Japan over and that had initiated the kamikaze campaign to begin with. So,
yeah. And what's your view of the kamikaze campaign? Having done the research, you know, all the knowledge you have of particularly the Pacific War, the Navy, what's your summary of the kamikaze campaign?
The summary I've got is that it did Japan more damage in the long run than it did the United States. And again, that's not because of the military effects of the campaign, but because of the effects of losing some of their best and brightest leaders, particularly early on in the campaign. But even later, anybody that's capable of flying an airplane is going to be an above-average individual. So they're taking these above-average individuals and essentially turning them into guidance systems for cruise missiles, which is a tremendous waste of human potential.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Mark, it's a fabulous book. I really enjoyed it. It was my first real insight to kamikaze. So thank you so much for that. Yeah. But you're a prolific author. You've got to have had more books out? What are you working on? What can we expect to see from you coming out next?
This one you'll love. Next spring, I have a book about the bombing campaign against Tokyo, which looks at the destruction of Tokyo by the 20th Air Force. And again, it goes from the first raid, which actually wasn't in Tokyo. It was attacking one of the aircraft factory in a Tokyo suburb, to the very end of the war. So there's that one. I've got a book coming out this fall on Sunderland versus U-Boat. And that one looks at the history of the Sunderland attacks on the U-boats. And the Sunderland ended up being, I believe, the third most effective airborne submarine killer of World War II. And it managed that, even though it could only use depth charges. The other aircraft were able to use homing torpedoes and the high-velocity rockets, particularly the Liberators.
That's going to interest me, I think, Mark. Yeah. I think that's going to interest me. Goodness me, Mark, you're busy.
It's fun.
Airplanes are fun.
Yeah, the day job is working out part of the Lunar Gateway program. And, for example, I spent yesterday sitting in on a technical interchange meeting about contingencies on the lunar surface. So,
Wow. Does the historical stuff give you a change of scenery to relax your mind from that day job?
And it's more than that. You can carry a lot of lessons from the past into the future. The odd thing about where I'm working now is somehow I've turned into the ancient spacefarer since I've been working in one NASA program or another since 1979. You know, writing, at least for me, is the way I unwind. But it's the thing about writing these books, the difference between what I thought was going to be the book and what actually comes out as a result of what I learned when I'm writing the book. This book actually was a good example of that, the Kamikaze book, because, you know, I did not realize, for example, how much the U.S. had modified their approach in order to counter the Kamikazes, and also didn't realize how much of it was pushed from below. The classic view of it and tends to be that the Japanese high command ordered their men to do this, whereas what turned out was they were sort of dragged kicking and screaming into doing it, and then felt obligated to continue it due to the sacrifices that the earlier Kamikazes had made. So it's things like that that are the reasons that I end up writing these books. You know, it's amazing what turns up as you go through the writing process.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating book. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us today. Where can we find out about you online?
I have a website, marklardis.com. You can also find me at the Osprey blog, because I'll typically do a blog posting. And I actually do a weekly book review on a site called ricochet.com.
Right, okay. And we'll put links to those in the show notes, and we'll put links to those with this episode. Mark, thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to have done it. It's fun to talk about this stuff because I bore my friends and relations.
No, you got easy listeners here. Listen, we'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the extended supporter family, including Mick Oakey, the aviation historian, and Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. We continue to bring you diverse and original aviation content. If you enjoy our program, please leave us a review or a feedback on your podcast player. You can find me and Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads feeds. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Mark.
Goodbye. Good to speak to you folks.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. It is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XCP Media.